Welcome to the 88th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Terry Chad.
It's 16 years to the day since a mostly very dull Duleep Trophy final match between North Zone and West Zone. Bowler Rashid Patel, however, decided to liven things up by attacking the batsman with a stump. Welcome to the podcast that will never endorse violence, but always welcomes enthusiasm.
Possibly the best thing about this entire episode is the interview that Patel gave later to the Indian publication Midday. He said this: "Look, cricketers are generally good guys, but things happen in the heat of the moment when the pressure gets to you." And then when he was pushed to explain exactly what it was that annoyed me, he said, "To me, they were playing defensive cricket. So we now know that if someone shoulders arms outside the off stump, you've got ample justification to get violent with a stump." Anyway, in the 88th episode of Reverse Swept Radio, we're going to be talking about international cricket all the way down to some happenings on the on Moore Park in Sydney in my little 2020 game this morning. I'm going to be talking about the great West Indian cricketer Lawrence Rowe and his extraordinary life and career. And we're going to be reviewing the book Laughter at the Wicket by Harry East. Now, Andy, you've had a bit of a moment of enlightenment over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think I'd describe it as a mini epiphany. Now, I realised a few months ago when we reviewed the book 28 Days Data on this podcast that I'm part of England's historic problem with one-day internationals. I'm the classic love the test.
You can't bat, you can't bowl, and you can't field. Sorry.
The bits and pieces cricketer. Yeah, a very, very proud English tradition. Me and Jamie Dalrymple. But I'm that sort of classic love the test matches, but don't really know what to do when we get to the ODI stage of the tours. And yet, watching the recent dead rubber between India and England, I realised that I've spent far too much time caring about, you know, context and caring about whether this game was significant enough to remember in a few months' time. And I should just enjoy the game. This match was absolutely superb. Some wonderful individual performances went all the way to the final ball, you know, constant shifts in momentum. And I keep thinking that actually maybe there's nothing wrong with actually just appreciating games on their individual merits. You know, stop looking for wider significance and treat these ODIs like the great exhibition matches that they basically are.
It feels as though the idea of series in general are kind of becoming less and less important in this day and age. You see, you know, back in the day, we used to play 7 ODI series and things like that, and 5 test series indeed. And actually now I think the only test series that runs to 5 matches is actually the Ashes. And on the whole, I think that's been quite a good move. Well, in some cases, a good move away from having long, long series between teams and actually just having one-off matches in order to call it. And actually another point of comparison is that whichever World Cup it was, the one that went on forever and ever and the group stages had about, you know, 7,967 games in them, and everyone got really, really bored. And one of the reasons why everyone got really bored is there's a sense that those games didn't matter. The only games that actually mattered were the ones that decided the knockout stages and went on from there. And one of the things that's been really successful about, for instance, the Big Bash League in Australia is that every single game is hyped up. There's no sense that, oh, this is just a, you know, this is just the early stage and no one really cares who wins and we'll get to the business end later. There's a sense of every single individual game actually really matters. So maybe actually you're just, you know, coming to a party that's already kind of happening in the out there in the world as well.
I think there's a lot of thinking going along in terms of the higher echelons of the game about this sort of quality versus quantity debate, and we'll see where we end up with this. Now, we have got a very entertaining potentially test series coming up, but one of Australia's greats has already told us what the result's going to be.
Yeah, so I was amused to read that Ricky Ponting had come out and said basically, you know, if Australia play really well, the best they can hope to do is lose honourably. It's, you know, basically a direct paraphrase of what he said to the media a few days ago in the test series against India that starts in just a few weeks. Now, Ponting's obviously talking both as an ex-player, ex-captain of Australia, and as a kind of pundit, but he actually also, interestingly, has an official coaching position with the, I think he's now the assistant coach for the 2020 side for the Sri Lankan games coming up. So he actually has an official position within Cricket Australia, and I actually quite enjoyed the fact that, you know, I didn't really think there was anything particularly defeatist about his comments. There was just a real reality about the fact that, you know, going, and he knows it as captain, you know, he never famously never won a series in India. He knows the challenge of going there and having to play a test. And, you know, usually you get captains that come out with all of this, you know, captains and coaches and everything and official staff who come out with all of this, oh, well, you know, if we hit our areas and we, you know, whatever else nonsense they come up with, then we're, you know, the game can be ours and that kind of thing. It's actually kind of a refreshing attitude towards the whole thing.
I don't know if I'm overthinking this, but I also do wonder whether there's an aspect of this which is take the pressure off the team, because you do sometimes see this side of coaches where they basically say, look, we're the underdogs, we've got nothing to lose, and it's, I guess it's part of an attempt to make the team just go out there, play. So maybe there's a bit more going on there, a bit of amateur psychology from Ponty.
Now, that'll be a scrap at the top, and there's been what has been a little bit of a sort of scrap at the bottom in a way, although that's unfair to New Zealand, I suppose. The Bangladesh-New Zealand tests, which caught your eye?
Yeah, I mean, if I was to tell you that Bangladesh lost both tests of their tour of New Zealand, I mean, it feels about as predictable as cricket news can be. I mean, of course they lost. But this was an altogether better series than those bare statistics suggest, with Bangladesh proving for the first time that they can compete in foreign seam friendly conditions. I mean, in both tests, in the first innings, they really matched New Zealand. And I mean, in the first test, they ran up a sort of 500 plus score.
Yeah, with some brilliant individual performances actually throughout the series.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a tough tour, New Zealand. I mean, we've seen much better teams than Bangladesh really struggle with a very good seam attack in very seam-friendly conditions. So, in some ways, a very positive series for Bangladesh in that they showed they could compete, but sadly, the collapses in both tests in the second innings destroyed the hard work that had gone into those good starts. And I think they're at the stage in their development, Bangladesh, where they could really do with that breakthrough win, you know, a win away from home. They've absolutely proven to us, and we know it as England fans, that Bangladesh at home are a really tough proposition now, but they could really do with a breakthrough win away from home.
And it's always the problem with emerging test teams, and you know, we saw it with Zimbabwe for years as well, that absolutely they could have good sessions, but they could also have bad sessions, and ultimately if you have more bad sessions than good sessions, then you're going to lose games. And that was always the issue, that sense of, you know, the real frustration that comes with having the players to be able to, you know, stitch together a good bowling performance for an innings or a good batting performance for an innings, but then, you know, the joy of test cricket is you actually have to do that for two innings in order to get anywhere.
Now, we're coming to one of my, what's almost becoming a regular part of the show, and probably one of my favourite regular parts of the show, which is our update from Sydney Club Cricket. In fact, we must be one of the only podcasts in the world that deals with Sydney Club Cricket in the detail that we do. But let's have the latest update from the Last Man Stands competition.
We're all for the little people here at Reverse Rep Radio. It's not just test cricket for us. So yeah, I play for a little league in Sydney called Last Man Stands. It's actually an international phenomenon, and actually if anyone out there is keen to play a bit more kind of casual Sunday or evening cricket, I would recommend looking it up and finding your local league. It happens in a number of countries around the world, and it's a format 20 overs a side, but with a few kind of quirks. 8 players a side, 5 ball overs. If you're a batsman, you have to retire on 50, as I discovered to my shameless plug, as I discovered to my chagrin today when I hit my 50. How many balls? Oh, 27 balls. Sorry, and I knew want the full details. Anyway,
this was the under 13 attack, though, wasn't it? The under 13 B team bowling attack that you ruthlessly flogged.
It was, but you know, you've got to. You can only play against what's put in front of you. I think that's the idea, isn't it? And It's a really fun form of the game, mostly because inept cricketers like me can occasionally score 50s and then tell everyone about it. But also because there is a real sense of innovation around it. You know, the 5 ball overs mean that actually the game gets finished pretty rapidly. Things change over pretty quickly. It's a really good way of spending a couple of hours on a Sunday afternoon. There's also, you know, some little technological innovations, like the fact that they've developed this app that the umpire scores on, because we all know what it's like when you have a bit of a flustered kind of amateur umpire who probably isn't very good at counting to, you know, anything more than 5 already, who, you know, is trying to score, and every ball you have to, you know, you have to fill out the you know, total score and what's happened to the batsman and what's happened to the bowler, and it all goes horribly wrong somewhere along the way, and all the runs get attributed to one person, and then it all goes badly. So they have this really good little app that's really easy to use, and it updates in real time so you can watch on your phone if you're on the boundary or, you know, whatever. And that's great. But today I discovered something that sort of troubled me more than I thought it would, which was that they've now developed this thing whereby the coin toss is done by an app on the umpire's phone, which just really kind of peeves me for several reasons, one of which is that a coin toss is a very difficult thing to get wrong. I'm all for, you know, turning things, using technology to make things easier if they're difficult, but really tossing a coin shouldn't be beyond people who are about to go and hurl cricket balls at one another. And also, there is a part of me that thinks that, you know, fundamentally there are just aspects of the game that, you know, have been shared across games of cricket, across all formats for, you know, hundreds of years. And it's just nice to have that sense of continuity, the little coin that gets flicked up at the beginning and everyone gathers around eager to see which side it's landed on. And so that kind of tarnished my 50. I thought I'd just get that in there again.
From the archives, and in this episode, Toby is going to delve into the life story of West Indian great Lawrence Rowe.
So at the beginning of the last episode, Reverse Sweat Radio 87, we were doing our usual little browse of what happened on this day in cricket, and we came across the fact that on the 8th of January 1949, a West Indian cricketer by the name of Lawrence George Rowe was born in Kingston, Jamaica, which was 68 years to the day before we recorded that episode. Now, I've kind of vaguely heard of the name Lawrence Rowe, but I didn't know all that much about him. And the thing that immediately kind of caught our attention was the fact that he was allergic to grass, which we kind of, in a slightly sadistic way, found quite amusing. In the sense that a cricketer allergic to grass is, you know, not too far from a swimmer allergic to chlorine. And suddenly I thought that there's something to this guy. The first thing that I discovered about him when I was looking into his life is that actually his allergy to grass, which you'd think would be a pretty severe impediment, wasn't actually his greatest obstacle to playing cricket. His greatest obstacle to playing cricket was a condition called pterygium. I don't even know how you pronounce it. It's known colloquially as surfer's eye. And it's a growth that you get on your eyeball that impairs your vision. It's like a kind of it's a kind of cancer in a way. That, although it's not cancer, but it impairs your vision, and it's generally caused by spending too much time in the sun, particularly in dry heat. So Rowe, growing up in Jamaica, would have had ideal conditions to cultivate this surfer's eye, as it's known. He had surgery for the condition later in life, but ultimately he had to, well, later in his career, but ultimately he had to wear contact lenses, and his performances, because his eyes got kind of really watery, his performances really suffered as a result. He also had this grass allergy that was a kind of, you know, kind of hay fever that just meant that he had debilitating headaches whenever he went anywhere near a cricket oval.
I mean, what now, is staggering about starting your career with these sort of serious impediments is the fact that you then go on to achieve suggests that your natural ability must be quite something to compensate.
Well, exactly, because these things actually as well were only diagnosed quite late in life, and there's a feeling that he probably had them, you know, forever and a day, as you usually do with conditions that you've had all through your life. You just get used to it. You think, oh, it's normal that you can't see and, you know, that kind of thing, and that you have a headache whenever you look at a patch of green.
Yes, you do get these wonderful stories. Well, I say wonderful, but you do get these extraordinary stories of people who've had terrible eyesight all their lives, and they finally get tested, and they're like, oh, and they, as exactly as you say, they're like, oh, I didn't know I was supposed to be able to read that, you know, signpost 10 metres ahead of me. So,
yeah,
yes,
and,
I think there's an odd thing.
Life happens in colour, does it?
Yes, yeah.
But the most remarkable thing about Rowe isn't either the fact that he was allergic to grass or he couldn't see and he was a test cricketer. What was actually remarkable is his career in and of itself. One thing that I kind of love about him is the fact that he became renowned and in some quarters kind of hated for the fact that he used to, when he was kind of dispatching a bowling attack to all parts, he used to sort of stand at the crease whistling merrily to himself as if he sort of didn't have a care in the world. And actually this kind of optimistic attitude that he had towards life was something that was mirrored in the way that he batted. So Michael Holding, the great West Indian fast bowler, described Lawrence as the best batsman I ever saw. And Gary Sobers, obviously the great all-rounder, believed him to be the greatest ever West Indian batsman. And that really kind of says it all, really. And the stats back that up. On debut, he became the first ever cricketer to score both a double century and a century. So he scored a double century in the first innings and a century in the second innings in a game against New Zealand on his home ground. Against England in 1974, he scored 302, and he's one of only four West Indian batsmen. There are three others to have ever scored a triple century. And when you think that he sits in company alongside Gary Sobers, Chris Gayle, and Brian Lara, that really indicates the kind of quality of his batting. Ultimately, his career did go on to be pretty heavily affected by his various afflictions that most of us wouldn't have been able to get out of bed with, but he managed to go on and play 30 tests with an average of 44. And that average would surely have been higher had he not had those issues. And one thing that I think is I spent a lot of time doing this afternoon, and I would urge anyone with a bit of spare time to do is just look up Lawrence Rowe on YouTube and watch some of the clips of him batting, because he is one of the most extraordinarily elegant batsmen I've ever seen. He's one of these batsmen who never looks as if they're actually kind of going at the ball, never forcing the ball. When you compare him to, say, a Chris Gayle in that list of other West Indians who have scored triple centuries, he, a lot of it's a lot of cuts and glances. He only ever comes onto the front foot when he can just play, unfurl these beautiful, effortless drives, and just it's he's one of those batsmen who is all about the timing, which again is something that's really remarkable.
And I guess this also makes him quite special in the pantheon of West Indian batting greats, because actually, the West Indians have produced a staggering number of real hard hitters, batsmen who go at the ball very hard and do sort of really brutal things to it when they hit it. So the idea of a batsman who's much more, as you say, about elegance and sort of the subtleties, must reserve him quite a sort of special place in West Indian cricketing history.
Well, it's interesting that you should mention the idea of a special place in West Indian cricketing history, because Rowe has a very checkered history, and this is the other interesting thing about him in terms of his place in the way that he's seen as a West Indian and Jamaican cricketer. So it was actually when after his retirement from the playing for the West Indies that he actually achieved, despite all of these great feats on the test pitch, and indeed he played for World Series cricket, scored an amazing 170 for World Series cricket down in Australia. But it was actually after he retired from all that he actually really, actually hit the front pages rather than the back pages. And that's because in 1982-3, he captained a rebel side that travelled to South Africa to play against the team there. South Africa at that point obviously were isolated from international sport because of their apartheid policy, and the reaction from the West Indian public to this was pretty overwhelming, because obviously there you have a essentially an overwhelmingly black nation in the West Indies, reacting to the oppression of black people in South Africa. And immediately Rowe was held up as being essentially a traitor to the public, to the extent that when he came back from that tour, he actually went and lived in Florida, because he had decided that his life kind of wasn't worth living in the West Indies.
And I think this is what's interesting here, is that we've had the example, obviously, in England of how people were treated when they went to South Africa and they played at that period. But I guess that just doesn't compare with the attitude of a West Indian public, given the sensitivities there.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, the issue remained a live one for a good 30 years after that. So in 2011, it was decided that the pavilion at Sabina Park, which is the main ground, in fact the only kind of international ground in Jamaica, it's the ground that infamous test match between England and the West Indies had to be abandoned at, in whenever that would have been 2008 or something. You remember that game that was
the
abandoned after two
62 the
balls because
62 ball.
it fell
Oh yeah.
apart. But anyway, yeah, no, not the one where England got bowled out, but where the pitch was too bad to actually play cricket on it. But anyway, that's besides the point. In 2011, this is Rowe's home ground. It's also where he scored his double and single century on debut. And, quite appropriately, there was this idea that the pavilion should be named after him. And there was a ceremony that happened. And during the ceremony, he got up 30 years after the incident And he acknowledged the fact that he was wrong to go to South Africa. He was wrong to go there and to lead the team to an apartheid South Africa with everything that was going on. Very shortly after that, that happened in kind of July and October 2011, the Jamaican Cricket Association actually reversed their decision to name the pavilion after him, because he had reportedly, in an interview on a local radio station, he had said that he actually didn't think he'd done anything wrong by leading the tour to South Africa. And such were the kind of ongoing sensitivities around this that the Jamaican Cricket Association immediately turned around and said, actually, we don't think we can go through all of this.
This is a fascinating example, isn't it, of just how long does it take for these things to sort of be forgiven and for peace to be made? Because you would think by that stage you're talking 30 years, you know, South Africa's obviously transformed, the West Indies move. You would think you'd maybe getting to that stage. But, I mean, it sounds to an extent like he was in a position where if he said the right thing and committed to it, maybe they could have moved on. You know, maybe. I mean, was there a sense? I guess the fact that they had gone as far as being willing to make the decision to name it after him suggests that the public were open to that at that stage. I don't know if you got any sense in your research whether there was acceptance.
Clearly the Jamaican Cricket Association took a long time to. I mean, they did actually take 2 months to make this decision to reverse it. You know, they didn't take it lightly. It wasn't just a knee-jerk kind of press reaction almost to please people. And I mean, I suppose the thing is that when you do something, when you try to institutionalize someone to the extent that you do, when they are, when you name a stand after them or something, they become part of the cricketing association in a particular place. And I think there was just this feeling that you know, apartheid was just too big an issue to risk. You know, risk kind of having any ambivalence around the feelings towards it. There needs to be a real sense of, you know, this was something that was absolutely wrong, and we just can't muddy the waters around that. It's one of those, you know, I think Roe was in a tricky position in the sense that there are arguments on both sides about you know, touring apartheid South Africa. And, you know, whilst, you know, clearly it, in some senses it seems quite clear cut, there is a degree of nuance around it. And he very much found himself kind of caught up in this. And there were other, you know, black West Indian cricketers who went on this tour. And he, because he was the captain, you know, very much became the figurehead. And as I say, had to end up leaving Jamaica and going and living in America. What is actually quite touching is that in 2015, so he was living in Florida, still is living in Florida. And he launched his own, the Lawrence Road Cricket Foundation in Fort Lauderdale, which is the foundation that's actually ended up staging those international T20 games that have happened in Fort Lauderdale. But it's also a kind of grassroots association designed to sort of just bring the game at a more widespread level in Florida. And when he launched it in 2015, a kind of astonishing panoply of West Indian cricketers, both his own contemporaries and people who came after him, you know, all the way up to the kind of Lara generation, came and were part of the, you know, the sort of opening celebrations and played a 2020 game and their kind of exhibition match and everything like that. So there is a kind of sense that he has regained, at least among his peers, and often that's the most important place for these things to happen. He's regained a place, a rightful place in the kind of history of West Indian cricket. So, to the review, and for this episode, we have been reading Laughter at the Wicket by Harry East, subtitled Echoes from the Golden Age of Yorkshire Cricket. And this book was recommended to us by our listener Rodney in South Africa. Thank you very much for bringing this book to our attention, which I have to say is not a book that we had ever come across, and we probably ever would have come across. So Harry East, the journalist, is someone we have been able to find out virtually nothing about. This book was published in 1980 in Yorkshire. It seems that Harry East was a journalist for a number of Yorkshire papers, but beyond that, we can't tell you anything else about him, which is quite nice, actually, because all we have, you know, to go on is just this quite beautiful book. So we didn't know what to expect with this book, Andy. How did you find it?
It was an absolute joy. The title, Laughter at the Wicket, promises comedy, and there certainly is comedy aplenty. I think the tone is set in the first line. I'm told they play cricket in other places besides Yorkshire. On reflection, I realise that they must. Otherwise, we should have nobody to beat. But I think while there is plenty of comedy, this isn't just a humorous book. There's an awful lot more to it. I mean, which were the bits that... I mean, I think this is such a... It leaves you very much with this kind of magpie instinct, this book. You just want to pick all the best bits out and tell everyone about them. But what were the bits that particularly appealed to you?
Well, I think one of the things that really comes across in the book is just the sheer joy of craftsmanship of writing about cricket, which is such an art. And it's an art that, you know, goes through different stages in time, as it were. And what this book really reminds me of is a Neville Carlis or a J.M. Kilburn, in the way that really there are a lot of these characters, these cricketers, who are brought to life in their characters. So, for instance, there's a chapter that describes the perfect bowler. So just quickly on the structure of the book, basically it's a series of reasonably short essays that just talk about different aspects of Yorkshire cricket at the turn of the 19th century. And there's a chapter called The Perfect Bowler, which is talking about a bowler called Ted Peat, who I'd never heard of before. And it's this brilliant mixture of stats and anecdotes and descriptions. And just one line of the description, as Andy says, you know, we could just read out the entire book from beginning to end. Harry says this of Ted Peat: he was a master of length and flight. He could pitch and float the ball to his whim, luring the adventurous to catastrophe, blandly coercing the hesitant and timorous to their doom. And the idea of blandly coercing, I just think, is the most brilliant thing. And suddenly, you have all of these cricketers from 100 years ago who you really feel as if you're kind of getting to know throughout the book, particularly the ones that you've kind of never heard of, but also some of the ones who are famous as well.
And this is absolutely why, to sort of revisit my earlier point, this is so much more than a funny book of cricket anecdotes that the title would suggest. I mean, that writing there on Peat suggests, you know, a wonderful understanding of the technical side of cricket, you know, of how cricket is played, of how wickets are taken. But it's also, this book is, I know it's an overused phrase, but it is something of a labour of love. I mean, these great Yorkshire cricketers are clearly people who East admires hugely, and these essays are tributes. And he's very effective at getting to what made their personalities sort of special. Again, as Toby said, we could spend the whole episode just reading out great lines, but I will treat you to one more. Louis Hall: thin as a lathe, saturnine, heavy moustached, of stern ascetic appearance, Louis, both in his life and his cricket, eschewed the devil and all his works. I mean, in that line, you've done more than some entire biographies do on a cricketer. There's also a real appetite for miscellany, so he kind of just you drop in from time to time these just wonderful little observations that of things he's obviously come across. I don't know which your favourite was. I was very fond of the discovery that single wicket master Fuller Pilch used to carry a scythe around with him to mow the outfield before a game began. I think that was hard to beat.
There's also a brilliant set of anecdotes, and they just kind of come out of nowhere. It starts talking about one thing and then just gets distracted by another, you know, another tangential anecdote, which is one of the great things about good storytellers. There's a wonderful set of anecdotes about the relative kind of strengths of the stomachs, the kind of, you know, how much food can they handle of various cricketers, including Plum Warner, who was obviously a cricketer in his own right and then went on to be the England manager during the infamous Bodyline tour. And this anecdote about cricketers going to India and one of them getting horrible food poisoning and one of them not, but in a kind of slightly sort of Victorian way almost. It's always described slightly indirectly, this issue of food poisoning and everything. So in the same chapter as the Ted Peat, who we've just discovered as the perfect bowler, the most remarkable thing about it comes at the very end, when there's this anecdote being told about him bowling at the Oval in 1882, which may ring some bells, in a test match against Australia. And he's a bowler, he's a spinner who actually opens the bowling, Harry East tells the anecdote of him coming in at the very end of the Test match. It's the last day. England need, I think, 9 runs to win. He's an appalling batsman, you know, can hardly put bat on ball. We can all picture this scenario. He goes in and everyone tells him, look, just block it out. There's a decent batsman at the other end. Just get him on strike. He'll get the runs. Don't do anything silly. And so he goes into, Ted Peake goes into bat, and of course, you know, third ball, he decides to go for glory, and he takes a massive heave at it, and he gets bowled, and that is, you know, the end of the game. England have lost to Australia. And he's coming off the pitch, and everyone says, what on earth are you doing? And he says, oh, you know, he's kind of jokingly self-deprecating. He says, oh, I didn't trust the guy up the other end. I knew I had to score them all myself. Ha, ha, ha. And then later on in the evening, someone finds him sitting in the corner of the dressing room, drinking by himself, looking really morose, and this guy goes up to him and says, you know, what actually was going through your mind at that point? It seemed like madness. And Pete says, I won't try and do the Yorkshire accent. He says, I was thinking how they'd all say good old Ted when it went sailing over the pavilion. And instantly, that is the most kind of heartbreakingly relatable for anyone who's ever played cricket. You could absolutely relate with that sense of, oh, I can be the hero in this instance. But the thing that Harry East doesn't actually mention is, of course, that is the Test match that founded the Ashes. It's from Ted Pete having got bowled out in England, not having got those last 9 runs, that there was the lament in the whichever newspaper it was about England cricket, English cricket being dead. So there's this real focus on the kind of characters and the kind of psychological drama of the game over and above some kind of great sort of historical significance to it.
Now, while the writing is fantastic and the stories are a joy, this book is almost worth its merit just in terms of the pictures. There are some wonderful illustrations and some beautiful old photos. The personal favourite, a wonderful shot of Sutcliffe, mid-pull shot. And Sutcliffe's often talked about in terms of his movie star good looks. And it's wonderful at this point because he's looking so debonair, so composed, and it's almost as if he's kind of posing here. It's just an absolutely wonderful shot that very much gets to the kind of cricketer I think he was. The book ends, as a book like this, I guess, almost inevitably does, with a certain sort of sorrow and nostalgia. Talking of these Yorkshire greats, East says, "We shall not see their like again. Cricket has been immolated to the god of gold and the titillation of spectators, to popularising the game for every yobbo who can wave a flag, blow a trumpet, or rattle an empty beer can." And you think that this is written sort of several decades before the arrival of T20, and you can't help thinking what a Harry East would have made of that today.
Particularly because he goes on in the next paragraph to say, we limit the overs, cover the wicket and change the ball every hour or so, rather than, as William Gunn so succinctly put it, play with one till the bloody cover drops off. And I actually wondered when I was reading this, is there some irony going on here? But it really seems as if there's not, as if there's a real sense of, you know, here's someone who is, remember, he's writing in 1980, so he's writing about cricket that happened 80 years before. A man who's so completely engrossed in the cricket of the past that suddenly everything in the present pales into comparison. So that's Laughter at the Wicket by Harry East. It's actually remarkably easy to get hold of it. I just ordered it off the book depository that usually doesn't have much in the way of cricket books, but you know, it seems to be pretty readily available online. And so thank you very much, Rodney, for recommending that to us, and we would pass on the recommendation heartily to anyone who is in for a good read.
That was the 88th episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. Thank you as ever for joining us. Having just really enjoyed a book that we had recommended by a listener, we would love you to do the same. So if there is a favourite book you have that we haven't reviewed before on the show, do get in touch, let us know, and we will endeavour to give it a read.